Well, it's good to see everybody tonight. Austin's going to lead us in prayer, and then we'll get into our introduction to the book of Joshua. Well, in this introduction, we'll be very brief about this. The author, we don't know the date. The expression where he uses "to this day" indicates a short, very short period between the end of the book and the writing of the book. We know that when he uses "we" and "us," as in chapter 5, then there's some eyewitnesses still around. We know that Rahab was still alive at the time the book was written, chapter 6, verse 25. So that narrows it down considerably. Some of the material is in chapter 18 when they're looking at the inheritance of the land was written during the events that took place. And then some of it we know was pre-Davidic. It's before David in 2 Samuel 5 took his men and encouraged the one who would go up the shaft, apparently some kind of water shaft, to take Jerusalem, which before then had become Jebusalem. And then it was turned into Jerusalem sometime in the period of David's reign. The purpose of it is to continue the history that the Pentateuch started. It takes up where Deuteronomy leaves off. So you have Deuteronomy getting Moses to Mount Nebo. He looks across the way. He sees all these territories that his people are going to receive. He won't be there. He's going to die there on Mount Nebo. Then Joshua will lead them on to the Promised Land. This purpose also, the B part, to prove God's faithfulness. He will keep his promise. If we can understand that in chapter 21, and we'll see again in chapter 23, when God tells these people that I have fulfilled everything I said I would give you, all this land I said I would give you, you have received it, that takes away the desire of some to say, well, maybe someday God will restore Israel to the land, or maybe someday this land will fulfill this scheme in the premillennial view. Even if you overlook Ezra and Nehemiah, it's hard to get over these earlier passages. So understand that God did exactly what he said he would do to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It illustrates God's holiness. He judges iniquity not only in the nations of Canaan, but also in the nation of Israel. So you see in chapter 7, Achan himself meets the judgment of God when he takes the accursed things. In Genesis 15, there's a period of time where God waits for the iniquity of the Amorites to become full, some 400 and something years. As a result, he waits till the time is just right. He doesn't go in before they're ripe for judgment. Then he goes in, and this is where the book of Judges, Joshua and part of Judges come in. And at the same time, when one of his own fails, he makes the judgment known to them as well. It shows God's grace. He gives Israel the promised land. This is something that you see over and over and over again in the book of Joshua, especially the first several chapters. This typifies the rest that we can receive, and then it demonstrates God's power. Imagine crossing the flooded Jordan without even having to get your ankles wet, or the fall of Jericho without even having to fling a single bomb to bring down the wall, or the well-aimed hailstones that fell upon people who were the enemies who were in flight, or the long day that gave the Israelites longer time to be able to defeat their enemies. And then the last part of the purpose to show the necessity of human involvement and obedience. God gives, but they have to take. He gives, but he doesn't send it down already cultivated and prepared to move in without a fight. They have to fight for what they get. So he gives, but he makes sure they understand that while he's giving, they must take. The main character, of course, is Joshua. That means Jehovah saves, or the Lord is salvation. The name Jesus is what you see corresponding in the New Testament to that. So Joshua, if he had lived in the same time as Jesus, would have been called Jesus. And then the information about Joshua, he led Israel in battle against the Amalekites as early as Exodus 17, right after they've crossed the Red Sea. The Spirit of God is in him. He's one of two faithful spies. When everybody else was falling, he and Caleb stood. He wholly followed the Lord. He was a type of Christ, as you see in Hebrews chapter 4, giving them the Canaan rest. Christ will give the ultimate heavenly rest. So the Jesus above gives an even better and a more permanent rest. The divisions of the book, the first 12 chapters, the conquest of Canaan, and it's done. And then in 13 to 24, the dividing of Canaan, and then the settling of issues about whom they're going to serve. Any comments over the introduction? Okay. As you look at the very first verse, let me suggest to you there are a couple of things we might do to get more out of the study. It could be that I could bring you every note I have or make sure these are on the internet. I'll try to do that anyway. Maps and different things of this nature. That's one way. That's a tool, I think, that may help, it may not help. I think what helps more than anything else, and one that is something that we should never overlook, is the ability on your part, while you're sitting there, if I or someone else says something, it may jar your mind to a better understanding of a verse. It may be that I don't even explain the verse or know how to explain it, but it may jar your mind to see how it fits in some better way. And if you were to be sitting there with a pen or with a good pencil and make those notes in the margins of your Bible, that's something you can use regularly as you go along. As we stand up here, we're doing what was done in Nehemiah 8. They read from the law, then they gave the explanation. Now, whether that explanation is oral or written, it's all one and the same thing. So we have oral explanations in classes like this. We have tracts and bulletins and other things that are in written form. If you would take a look at Dave Hansen's Bible and see the notes he has in it and how it's falling apart, and he won't get another one because he'd have to change all those notes, and I had to do that a few years ago, and it took me 5 years. That's the way to find what you want in a very quick way. And to continue to see that cumulative effect in it. If you put your notes in a notebook, that's good. I don't oppose that at all. I hope you will. But you don't always know where that notebook is. It may go missing. But you always know where your Bible is. So there, to me, is one of the best things you can do to make yourself grow more and more. And as a result, then I think that will be helpful to all of us. If I go too fast in any explanation, don't hesitate to say, could you run that by me again? Or just raise your hand and go like that, and I'll know what that means. I'm used to it. Okay, in the book of Joshua, chapter 1, after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, it came to pass that the Lord spoke to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, saying, and I'll break off right in the middle of that thought. When he brings up Moses, he does so for the first time in verse 1, speaking of him twice in verse 1, and then again in verse 2, again in verse 3, again down in verse 5, and then if you skip down to verse 13, and then 14, and then 15, and 17, two more times, 11 times in all in one chapter, one short chapter of 18 verses, Moses is referred to 11 times. That is remarkable. Many of the statements made about Moses, as the writer mentions him, give a tag to illustrate something about him. For example, in verse 1, Moses, the servant of the Lord. Verse 2, Moses, my servant, is dead. You may be the servant of the Lord, but your day is going to come. You're going to leave this world. You're not permanent. You're expendable. In verse 3, I've given you this place, as I said to Moses. And this is God talking. As I told Moses, that's what I'm telling you. So that shows in what he said to Moses, God hasn't changed and he keeps his word. In verse 5, no man will be able to stand before you. As I was with Moses, so I'll be with you. I stood by Moses in thick and thin, God said. I'll stand by you, Joshua, in the same way. And then as you see down in verse 7, that you may observe to do according to all the law which Moses, my servant, commanded you. Moses was the writer of the law. He not only wrote brought back the tablets that God's finger wrote, but he also wrote those in these book forms, the first five books of the Old Testament. And then down in verse 13, remember the word which Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you. Talking about God giving them rest, that gives them not only the requirement to keep in mind what he's written, because that's something all Israelites are supposed to do anyway. But he gives them hope because they're going back as far as Moses. God said he would give you this land, and he will. He's always said this. In verse 14, the land which Moses gave you on this side of the Jordan, God has already shown what he's capable of doing by giving Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh their location on the east side of the Jordan River before we even cross the Jordan. In verse 15, Moses, the Lord's servant, he mentions again. And then 17, Moses and all things, we heeded him. So we're going to heed you as he was with Moses. May he be with you. And so you can see various points. If any of you are looking for a sermon on Moses, I think you could go to Joshua 1 and find quite a bit, a lot of information about him just in these 11 references. A couple of them repeat, but there's a lot of information here. So after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, it came to pass that the Lord spoke to Joshua. And so we have from verse 1 through 9 what is stated to Joshua. God is talking to Joshua. That's verses 1 through 9. In verse 10 through the end of this chapter, we have what is from Joshua. Joshua is doing the talking. So verses 10 to 18, it's from Joshua. Verses 1 to 9, it's to Joshua. Okay? And then we have in verse 2, Moses, my servant, is dead. All the comfort that could have been gotten on Joshua's part from Moses is over. Moses will never encourage you again. He'll never instruct you again. He'll never give you advice again. He's gone. Now, you're filling his shoes. Those are pretty big shoes to fill. But he says, my servant Moses is dead. Now, therefore, arise, go over this Jordan, you and all this people, to the land which I am giving to them, the children of Israel. You'll notice what he tells him to do in verse 2. Arise and go over this Jordan and get this land. In verse 6, he gives another imperative. Be strong and of good courage. More about that in due course. The third one is also in verse 6. For to this people you shall divide as an inheritance the land. So we've seen three commands. Rise, go over this Jordan. In verse 6, be strong and of good courage. You can do whatever God tells you to do with or without Moses. 3, still in verse 6, you will divide this land as an inheritance. So after they conquer, they will divide. They will divide and conquer. And then the fourth one is given in verse 7. Only be strong and very courageous, that you may observe to do according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded you. I'm commanding you to keep what Moses has already commanded you. So here's God commanding Joshua to do what Moses commanded, because God commanded back then, and he's repeating it here. Those four commandments Joshua receives. Now, this first one in verse 2, arise and go over the Jordan, you and all these people, to the land. What land? Where do you first read about the land these people were to go in and receive? Where is it? Where would you go?
The first reference, Genesis 12:3.
Genesis 12. Let's go back there very quickly. I'm sorry? Well, you're right, though. It's in that whole context. In Genesis 12, the Lord said to Abram, get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house to a land. Look at that. There's a land. And he hasn't even told him at this point where he's going. He's going to leave a known place, or the Chaldees, for an unknown place. He doesn't know where he's going. To a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great. You shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. I will curse him who curses you, and you all the nations of the earth will be blessed. You're going to a land you don't know about, but what you do in that land and my blessings I'll give you in that land will cause the entire lands, all the lands of the world, to be blessed. Now, down in verse 5, Abram took Sarah his wife and Lot his brother's son and all the possessions that they had gathered and the people whom they had acquired in Haran, and they departed to go to the land of Canaan. So they came to the land. Verse 1 just said a land, but here to the land of Canaan. So they came to the land of Canaan. Abram passed through the land to the place of Shechem, as far as the terebinth tree of Moreh, and the Canaanites were then in the land. The Canaanites were the current owners. They weren't interested in moving. They didn't want someone to come and force them out or to evacuate them. But their time is not up yet. God will give them 400 plus years, so that their iniquity will become full. Their cup of iniquity still has some space in it. They are not as bad as they can be, and God is being very, very, very patient with them. But the day will come, and it has come in Joshua, when that time has gone, the sand has dropped all the way through the hourglass, and God's judgment is at hand. That's verse 2 of Joshua 1. And then verse 3, every place that the sole of your foot will tread upon, I have given you, as I said to Moses. Now, I have given you. Context determines the tense in such verbs. I know that. But there is no doubt that he's expressing a certainty. It is so certain that it's going to occur. He states it as though it's already happened. I have given you. Now, if I went up to one of you and said, here is $50. Go eat out in a nice place. And I come back later and say, what did you do with that money that I have given you? There's nothing unusual about that, is there? But if I were to walk up to you tonight, I walk up to Tim and say, Tim, here's this $50 I've given you. What'd you do with it? He said, what $50? They're not in the land yet. But he says, I've given you. But it is so absolutely certain that he states it as though it's already done. And this is one of the most common figures that is found all through the Bible. Isaiah is filled with this kind of talk. Because when God says something, it is certain. Unless there's a condition involved that man would mess up. But you see the point here. Here's the faith we have in God for the day.
There are different expressions for that. The one I've always liked is prophetic past.
Yeah, or prophetic perfect, either way. Perfectly right, if you'll pardon the pun. Yes. Any others? Okay, but keep that figure of speech in mind. You will see it all throughout this book, especially from here through chapter 6. You'll see it all throughout passages in the Old Testament where God is saying, I've done something, but it hasn't even happened yet. We can't do that. We may die before we fulfill a promise. That's not going to happen with God. So, in verse 4, he says, from the wilderness and this Lebanon, as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites to the great sea toward the going down of the sun shall be your territory. Okay, let's talk for a moment about... let me do this. I'm about to forget something I wanted to do. The outline of Joshua, I'll leave that up there for a minute. It divides up very nicely from what you see in chapter 1. In chapter 1, verse 2, crossing the Jordan, you'll see that done in 1 through 5, 12. The conquest, chapter 1, verse 3, what he refers to there will actually take place in 5, 13 to 12, 24. The distribution of the land in chapter 1, verse 4, will actually take place in 13 through 22. And then Joshua's life that he's to live, chapter 1, verse 5, will be illustrated very clearly in 23 to 24. Now, maybe that was long enough. As you look at this land promise that was given here, you have the territory of King Saul looking something about like this. The territory of David going at least this far in solid matter, and up as far as this, at least in a tangential way. But when it comes Solomon's turn to reign, this is just full-fledged Israel. And you notice this river that's running along right through here, that's the Euphrates. And so from the river of Egypt to the river, they typically call it the river, and all this land in between, this was a very, very incredible land promise to a tiny, tiny nation. And it will never be that large again throughout the rest of the Old Testament. It will get close in Jeroboam II's reign, but never, never like this. Okay. As you look at Moses here, Moses is dead. Four things about Moses. Number one, he led a very long life, didn't he? How old was Moses when he died? I thought I heard it. 120, did you say it? 120. Look at the wrong direction. Methuselah. How old was he when he died? 969. So Moses was a young fellow, wasn't he? 120. But look at us. We're not going to reach 120, most likely. Moses lived a long time, but he's dead. Even Methuselah died. We're going to die. Every one of us will reach our end, and the more we can do to help people fill in whatever gap we may leave when we're gone, the better off the Lord's plan will work out. Number two, he was a good man, yet he still died. Good men die too. Precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of his saints. Psalm 116, verse 15. Then three, he was a servant of God. Hebrews 3 makes this point. It's comparing Moses and Christ. Moses was a servant in the house of the Lord, but Christ the Son. But imagine this epitaph on Moses' tomb. And there is no epitaph on Moses' tomb. And why is that? Nobody knows where he's buried. God said if they know where he's buried, they'll make some idol out of it, perhaps. There was some way in which Satan contended with the angel Michael, wasn't it, over the body of Moses. And I don't know if that meant he wanted to make it to some sort of idol or not. But if there were to be an epitaph over the body of Moses, if it were to read what is stated in Joshua 1, Moses, comma, the servant of God, what an epitaph that would be. If any of us can live in such a way that people would say when they think of us, this man, this woman, the servant of God. That's what Moses could have. And that's from God himself. Then number four, Joshua's day is going to come too. If you trace through just a few chapters, just a few pages to Judges chapter 1. We go through this entire book in a period of a few years. And chapter 1 in Judges, the very first verse says, now after the death of Joshua. After the death of Joshua. In fact, the last part of Joshua is going to talk about how Joshua got old and didn't continue to live any more than Moses did. Joshua was replaced. In fact, Hebrews 9:27, it's appointed to men once to die and after this, the judgment. So Moses is dead. The second and the corollary to that is that Joshua takes his place. Joshua becomes the new leader. You see, three or four things about Joshua. He's been trained for this position for years, some 40 years. Now, Moses had been trained for about 40 years. Where was Moses trained for 40 years to be able to lead the children of Israel? Who was he leading for 40 years? Sheep. Easy task? Well, compared to leading Israel, yeah. The sheep at least don't backtalk, but Israel would. So it did at least get him ready, didn't it? That's Moses' training. The next 40 years, when Moses is going from 80 to 120, he takes in as sort of an apprentice Joshua. So it's as early as Exodus 17, after they've crossed the Red Sea in Exodus 14, that Joshua's leading the troops against the Amalekites who've bushwhacked, dry-gulched the children of Israel. And this is a very good period of training for Joshua. He's with Moses all this time, and he sees how they treat Moses. He sees what these people say. He hears what they say and sees what they do. And so that brings up the second part. In his training, he was tested by trials. If you look at Exodus 32, Moses comes down from the mountain. Joshua says, you know, it sounds like war going on down there. See, Joshua's a military man, and that's how he thinks. And Moses said, that's not the sound of war I'm hearing. And they get down there, and it's a drunken orgy. And that's when Moses breaks the tablets and makes them eat their own God. Joshua never falters. He never fails to go over to the wrong side. And one of the most famous cases, Numbers 13 and 14, when the 10 spies yield. And they become timid. And they become afraid. And they no longer believe in God. It was Joshua and Caleb who stood. And they said, we can do this. We need to have this faith in God. So he saw how difficult leadership was. And yet he continued anyway. Then the third thing, he was teachable. When the Lord gave a promise to Joshua, that was a done deal. He'll point out in verse 10, then Joshua commanded the officers of the people, saying, then he tells them to get ready. We're going into this land. We're going to conquer it, just like the Lord said. And that's back to verse 3. I've given it to you, just as I said to Moses, it's yours. So when I say it, it's going to happen. Now, this promise that was given here is one that Joshua had known of for some time, but it's one that they would have to fight in order to achieve. If you look at a comparison between Moses and Joshua, Moses the lawgiver, Joshua the one who actually leads them into Canaan. So Moses gets them well started on this journey, but Joshua has to finish it. If Moses dies and Joshua doesn't lead them in, they're a nation without a country. Moses is sent by God, so is Joshua, chapter 1, verse 5. God worked through Moses, God worked through Joshua, you'll see in chapter 3, verse 10 and other passages. Moses punished God's enemies, Joshua will do that par excellence. And then Moses led through the Red Sea, Joshua led through the Jordan. Both were miracles. We probably think more about the Red Sea than we do the Jordan, but they're both equally impossible, absolutely impossible for people to go through without the power of God letting them go through that. And then one more thing here, Jesus and Joshua. When you look at this comparison, the name Joshua, Yahweh saves, Hosea, salvation, Matthew 1:21, you shall call his name Jesus because he will what? Save his people from their sins. He will be called Jesus because he will save. See the connection here? Joshua would save them from any who would oppress them. Jesus would save in a similar way, only spiritually. He received miraculous attestation at the Jordan River. Who? Both did. Jesus at the Jordan when the Father's voice comes out of the heavens, "This is my beloved Son, whom I'm well pleased." Joshua's there when in chapter 3, he says, "This day I'll begin to magnify you in the sight of all these people, and they'll see you have taken the place of Moses." He didn't have a thing over you. You'll see also that both prepared and used 12 men. Joshua said, "I need 12 men. Come get these stones and take them up and set them up over in the camp of Gilgal." Jesus took 12 men, and you know how he used those. Both of them led a nation to the promised land. Joshua into the physical, material, Canaan promised land. Jesus, in John 4, says, quoting Psalm 95, that's not the true rest. It's a type of the true rest, but the true rest is heaven. And while they're in the promised land, they're in Canaan, David writes about the true rest that's to come, Hebrews 3 and 4. So, any comments? I'm doing too much of the talking. Comments on anything we've seen so far? Tim.
I was thinking about that phrase, arise and go. Deuteronomy ends with the people mourning for 30 days the death of Moses.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like Joshua can't get over that. And God says, you just need to get busy. It's time to get busy and leave that behind you.
Yes. You can't stay here with a pity party the rest of your life.
Yeah. It's a good lesson for us.
It is a very good lesson. Good point. That's why I come to Bible class. Steve.
You know, kind of going with that theme too, and putting back to then in Deuteronomy 34 about that, and bringing that into verse 2, the very first thing the Lord tells Joshua, he said, "Moses, my servant, is dead." Stay.
Mm-hmm.
And just like it seemed, and I know we've discussed it a little bit as far as saying, well, you don't realize you're going to have Moses to speak with or anything like that or advice. But do you think, too, if we pull that back here to Deuteronomy 34, when Moses leaves the people, and Joshua being one of them, he just goes up to Mount Nebo. The people don't see Moses die. So, and we know that they wept for him for 30 days as far as weeping for his death and so forth, but perhaps there was still some question there. Was Moses really dead? And this very first statement that God says to Joshua, confirms it, perhaps, as far as confirms without a doubt in Joshua's mind. Now it's your turn.
Very interesting. That would make it parallel to 2 Kings 2 when Elijah goes up in the chariot and they think maybe he's dropped on a mountain somewhere up here. We don't really know. He's dead. Very interesting. I hadn't thought of Deuteronomy 34 that way. Again, that's why I come to Bible class. Anybody else with some gems? Okay. If you think of anything, don't hesitate to bring those up. Now, in verse 4, from the wilderness, he says, what I've told Moses, from the wilderness in this Lebanon, as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites, and to the great sea, that's the Mediterranean, toward the going down of the sun, shall be your territory. He uses the Hittites here to stand for the whole, a synecdoche, a part for the whole. Then verse 5, no man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave you nor forsake you. Can you imagine someone coming to you, some United States official perhaps, if you're in the military, and he says, I've chosen you to go over to Iran, and then after you get through with them, I want you to talk to the head of ISIS, and I want you to tell them you straighten up and behave, or we're going to bomb you to smithereens. Boy, what a great mission that would be, wouldn't it? Well, what am I to take with me on this mission? Take a yardstick and say, speak softly and carry a big stick. So be straightened up or we're going to give you a spanking. And that's it. Anybody volunteer? Can you imagine? Here's Joshua about to go in to fighting. It is a military operation. And yet in verse 5, the assurance is this. No man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. I was with Moses and you saw what happened. I will be with you in exactly the same way. I will not leave you or forsake you. This promise includes four items. The territory. The whole land is before you. The whole land is yours for the taking, and you can take it. We saw a moment ago on the map. The territory. Number two, it involves triumph. Nobody can stop you. One man with God is a majority. Look at David with Goliath. In Joshua 10, nature itself will fight against God's enemies. As the day stays, as the huge, huge hailstones fall on the enemies of God, selective bombing, they call that, don't they? And yet that's what God did to destroy those enemies. Or if you look at Judges 5 with the war of children of Israel against Jabin, king of Canaan, and Sisera, his captain, with all his 900 chariots of iron. The stars in their courses fought against Sisera. The whole world's against them. They have 900 chariots. Oh, it's time to be scared. No, we have God. That's what he's saying to Joshua. The territory, the triumph. Then third, the protection. I am with you. In Matthew 1, Emmanuel. What does Emmanuel mean? Call his name Emmanuel, which means what? God with us. That ought to mean as much as it did to Joshua. Then fourth, the presence. I will not leave you or forsake you. Now what does that signify? The last part of Numbers 14, when the children of Israel have found, we really messed up. We didn't trust God. We believe these spies. Now we're going to have to wander around in this wilderness. Okay, we change our mind. We're going to go up. We're going to go take the land. What happened to them? Remember? Last five or six verses of Numbers 14. What happened to them? They were slaughtered and ran away. Why? God was not with them. He's not going to be with those who don't trust Him. They had forfeited their opportunity to enter the promised land. He's not with them. The opposite is being said to Joshua. He is with you. King Saul gets to the point where since he hasn't been listening to God, God won't listen to him. 1 Samuel 28, he invites a witch to inform him what he needs to do. Samuel speaks to him. By this time tomorrow, you'll be in Hades. He goes on in chapter 31. He is slain by the Philistines. Why? Why does he lose? God was not with him. If God is not with you, you're like those folks in Numbers 14. You're like Saul. But if God is with you, you're like Joshua. And there is no force that can stop you from carrying out God's mission to you. Now, in verse 6, be strong and of good courage. For to this people you shall divide as an inheritance the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. You be strong and be courageous. That's verse 6. Verse 7, only be strong and very courageous. And verse 9, have I not commanded you to be strong and of good courage? Down in verse 18, the last part, only be strong and of good courage. Four times, three of them from God and the last one from the 2.5 tribes. Be strong and of good courage. What's he saying? 1 Corinthians 16, 13 gives five admonitions for the Corinthians. Watch, stand fast in the faith, be brave. What's our word in Joshua? Instead of being brave, he says be what? The synonym, courageous. And then be brave, be strong. What's the word here in Joshua for strong? It's the word strong. Same word strong, and then brave or courageous. So 1 Corinthians 16, 13 is telling us to do the same thing. Watch, stand fast in the faith, be brave, be strong, let all that you do be done with love. In verse 7, only be strong and very courageous that you may observe to do according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right hand or to the left that you may prosper wherever you go. That verse is so loaded. First, The repetition of verse 6 in being strong and very courageous. Why would God repeat himself? Joshua had just heard those words. Why does he say it again? Emphasis. He's emphasizing, you must trust me enough to be brave. You must trust me enough to have this courage that will take you wherever you need to go. Have this courage. So, the second part of verse 7. There are two that's in it. Why be strong and courageous? That you may observe all the law. Now, if it gets to the point where I tell you to do something, you say, well, I don't think that's going to work. We need to try something else. Do men ever do that? Yes. If you get to that point where you don't trust what I've written, or you trust what someone says instead of what God writes, you're going to be doomed to fail. Then the third thing, he says, that you may not turn from the right hand or to the left. You don't go this way or that. You go straight in the path that God has led you on. That. What's the that? That you may prosper wherever you go. What's the implication? You don't go this way, you won't prosper wherever you go. 2 John 9 is the same way. Whoever goes onward and does not what? Abide in the doctrine of Christ has not God. Yes, that's the same thought that he gives here. So, this is giving us the way to win from verse 6 through 8. First, be strong and courageous. Verse 7, obey all that God wants you to obey. And the result of that in verse 8, you will have success. The last words in verse 8, you will have good success. You will be prosperous. Verse 8 says, this book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate in it day and night, that you may observe to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have good success. Be strong and courageous. Obey all, just as in Matthew 28:20, teaching them to observe most of the things that I command you. So what Jesus said? All things that I've commanded you. And then here, study, verse 8. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth. You're to study it. It's to be a part of what you say and what you do. Psalm 1 is illustrated in this verse. Psalm 19 is illustrated in this verse. The times of this ignorance God overlooked, but now he commands all men everywhere to repent. Acts 17:30. So in that same chapter of Acts 17, verse 11, you see the Bereans studying daily, searching the Scriptures to see whether these things are so. They don't want to go left or right. They want to do exactly what God says. Then the fourth word is the word meditation. Again, in verse 8, meditate on it day and night. So be strong and courageous, obey, study, meditate day and night. In verse 9, have I not commanded you, be strong and of good courage? Yes, you've said it twice and this is the third time. Very, very emphatic. Do not be afraid, nor be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. God will not send you to a place where he does not also go. Now, God speaks to Joshua, verses 1 through 9. Joshua takes that message, and in verses 10 through 18, he speaks to the people what God wants him to tell them. Now, in verse 10, Joshua commanded the officers of the people, saying, pass through the camp and command the people, saying, prepare provisions for yourselves. For within 3 days you will cross over this Jordan to go in to possess the land which the Lord your God is giving you to possess. In 3 days, you're going to go into this land. Get ready for battle. So here's D-Day. That is just about here. Operation Jericho. We're going to go in and we're going to do what you've anticipated for all these years. Verse 10, verse 12. To the Reubenites, the Gadites, and half the tribe of Manasseh, Joshua spoke, saying, remember the word which Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, saying, the Lord your God is giving you rest and is giving you this land. He's giving you rest. Remember, memorize the words that Moses said. Have faith in God. Your wives, your little ones, your livestock shall remain in this land which Moses gave you on this side of the Jordan. And in Jeremiah 50, I think it's verse 37 or so, when Babylon is about to be destroyed by the Medo-Persians, The statement is made that the Babylonian soldiers will become weak like women. The Israelites found out 30, 40, 50 years ago when they tried to use women in combat positions, that whenever they would have a woman posed on the front line, their Arabian enemies fought twice as hard. They were not about to let a woman defeat them. And typically, a woman, when something like this is about to occur, goes to pieces. It's not true of every woman, but that was the census all throughout the Old Testament. Women were not to be the warriors. The men were to be the warriors. But on this occasion, half the tribe of Manasseh, along with Reuben and Gad, are going to be over on the east side of the Jordan River. They're going to leave. The soldiers are going to cross over the Jordan. They're going to be gone from 5 to 7 years fighting in the vanguard. They're going to be in the very front of the battle. They're going to be leaving their wives and their children on the east side of the Jordan, totally unprotected. They're women and children. The very kind that Jeremiah 50 said, they're going to be weak as. What hope do these men have when they come back that their women will be alive? What's the answer? They can't fight for themselves. That's obvious. What's going to happen? What will protect them? God will. And we must not overlook that as we go along. Okay, thanks for your help. We got through verse 14, and we'll be ready for 15 next time, the Lord willing. Appreciate your comments.